Ready to go to work here?
Ready.
Good afternoon, everyone. Council, please come to order. Sue, please call the roll.
Ritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Hales.
Here. We have a single time certain item on this afternoon, and Sue, if you would read that item.
Item 31, accept the minimum parking requirements for multifamily buildings memo referencing three pieces of research related to parking for multifamily buildings.
So we're going to hear some presentations from the Bureau on this subject, but I think before we do that, I think Commissioner Fritz in particular, who's done some work on this issue, has some comments.
Thank you, Mayor Harrells, and thank you all for being here today, delayed from December of last year. The council shares some of the community concerns about apartments being built with no parking. And I, over the summer, the council and I directed the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability under Mayor Adams to ask the Planning Commission, the Planning and Sustainability Commission, to hold a forum to review the issue. And so they did that on November 16th, and we asked them to bring a report back to us by the end of the year, which Planning and Sustainability was ready to do. However, the council had a lot of things on the agenda, and so we put it to this session, welcoming my two new colleagues on the council. And the purpose of this hearing is to review the report and what happened at the Planning Commission, and then my expectation is that we will be asking the Planning and Sustainability Commission, in partnership with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the community, to do some more work, hold a hearing, and come back to us in short order. So that's the framework of what we're discussing today. And Mayor Hales, I appreciate your support for bringing this report forward.
Great. Thank you. Other council comments before we get started? If not, Joe?
Great. Thanks. Well, good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Joe Zender. I'm Chief Planner with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And I'm going to give you a brief overview of the study that we've done related to the issue of new apartments and the parking requirement. You have full copies of all of the different research provided already. So the issue that we're focused on is the recent sort of spike in development of apartment buildings where no parking is being provided with the new apartments. It's triggered issues in the neighborhood that you'll hear about today, issues of concerns about neighborhood impact. But the impacts also go beyond parking. What we've heard from a lot of the discussions we've had, it's about a neighborhood leverage over projects like this, but also the design of the buildings, comprehensive plan issues that we're dealing with as part of the comprehensive plan update. Secondly, I just wanted to point out that the policies that we're going to be talking about today date from the 80s. I mean, their origins are in the current comprehensive plan, which was focused on promoting transit-oriented development and reducing what people were worried about was the proliferation of surface lots and kind of dead space in neighborhoods. So it was a different kind of world then, where the idea that you would build apartments with no parking wasn't what the banks were doing and we weren't seeing. So the comprehensive plan had a vision that tried to get out of the way, and that's been followed up with the Climate Action Plan, the Portland Plan, and the Transportation System Plan that have all led us in a direction of trying to reduce the oversupply of parking. So specifically, the provisions that are in the code related to this, there's one set, and this set dates from the 80s. This is in the current zoning code, which is that in commercial zones, the ones highlighted here in red, a lot of these are your neighborhood commercial zones. There's no minimum parking requirement. And as I said, the thinking in the 80s was the market will take care of this, because we weren't able to talk banks and developers into developing that much of this kind of parking of housing. The second provision came in the 90s, which was much more targeted towards advancing this idea of transit-oriented development. Where you have frequent transit, we wanted to get more residential units. We wanted to lessen dependency on the automobile, promote the strength of those local commercial districts, and create the alternative out there for more of these units without parking. So within 500 feet of a frequent transit service line, also the minimum requirement for parking per apartment unit was eliminated. So there's two provisions that are at play here. You can see in this, the red highlighted areas are your commercial zones, but so this applies to residential and other zones as well. Just to get a sense of the order of magnitude, there's 199,000 parcels in the city, so this zoning applies to about 38% of the parcel. So it's a large number of lots that are affected by this. That's all I was trying to show with this. So the changes that we would do would be far-reaching like that if we do changes. To get a handle, sort of an objective basis to respond to the community concerns, we conducted some research with David Evans and Associates on the issue. One part of this was looking at the last 6 years of permit data. What we found out by that is that over the last 6 years, most of the apartments have been built with parking and without parking, but the predominance of both buildings and units have included parking, and they've actually included, the ones that have included parking have included it almost at one space per unit. But at the same time, there have been buildings built without parking, and the average size of those tended to be on the 20-unit size, although they ranged, and that when you look at the number of the size of buildings, which is one of the things that the Planning and Sustainability Commission was trying to trigger on, is there a size, a threshold, where not requiring parking has more neighborhood impacts? Over half of the units without parking were in these 40 units and above buildings. A second piece of data from the permits is that there's an argument out there, and I think it's sound, that in the past, as I said, most you saw buildings with parking and without. But you can all recall with the mortgage crisis and the real estate finance crisis, what was getting built dramatically changed. And in that period, you're looking at 2008 to 2011 here, you can see the total number of projects dropped dramatically. And when it starts to recover, we're seeing a lot more of these buildings proportionally without parking. The other thing that happened in this period is you have to remember that Portland, over the last year, has a nationally low vacancy rate. So there is a pent-up demand for increasing the supply of apartments. There's a market niche now here that argues that we need to also keep in mind, is this a bubble, or is this going to be the new normal where you're seeing more buildings without parking than with? And typically, you see both types of buildings being built. And when you look at the total supply, as I said, it's even including all the buildings with parking and without, you're still overall providing a parking supply that's one for every two units on average across the city. Second part of the research we did, in addition to looking to permits, was to specifically look at eight new buildings with and without parking that are typical of or representative of the kind of buildings that people are having concerns about. And what we did with these buildings is we looked at the utilization of on-street parking. We did surveys of the tenants to see what their kind of behaviors were vis-a-vis owning automobiles and travel and the like. In the report, you're going to see the conclusions are that we found that in this sample, some buildings had parking, most did not, but still 72% of the respondents, of the occupants of these buildings, owned cars. That's less than you see citywide, so these buildings are performing, you know, lower in terms of vehicle ownership than your typical household unit in the city, but it's still, they do own vehicles. They outperform the rest of the city in terms of choosing to commute by transit, not by driving. It goes a good deal to the location of these buildings. 64% don't use the car to commute, but still when you look at the non-commute trips, especially you're seeing a lot of automobile uses. So the conclusion from this is that even though we are achieving some sort of transit benefit from the location of these buildings, it's not answering all the needs for trips, and people still feel the need to own a vehicle.
Joe?
Yes.
On the question of commute trips, do you happen to know what percentage of the respondents were actively employed and commuting?
We do not know that. We asked them, how do you commute? And do you commute by transit or commute by using your car? So the respondents that we got back that would say they commute, we assumed were employed. But we don't know the full demographic profile of all of the buildings. In terms of parking supply, and I'm going to show you some graphics related to this, we looked at on-street parking around these buildings, these eight sample buildings, and that we found that there is indeed congestion on some of the block faces. And actually, this is an interesting part in the study to look at more closely in your copies. But that we also found that there were always within a few block radius available parking, and that sort of to give you a sense of the magnitude of this, 71% of the residents find that they could find parking within 2 minutes of their apartment, and 80% took less than 5 minutes to find parking. So while there is congestion, and that can have a very significant kind of local impact if you take a bigger look, there seems to be the use of the public parking seems to have some capacity. And the way we did this was, like I said, looked at each of these individual buildings of our 8 samples, and I wanted to just show you a few just to sort of illustrate the kind of the way this works. This one is Irvington Garden at 15th and Hancock. This is 50 units, no parking. You can see, and this is a very active, this is 15th and Broadway, very active commercial area. The reds are where during our sample period here, which is a weekend evening, 80% of the street is occupied, and that's considered by the standard to be occupied. But you can see it grades off into yellow and green when you get a few blocks away, so that there is available parking supply. It's just farther from the unit. This was the most congested of the samples that we did. An interesting case in this, too, is that, I don't know if I can highlight this, but there's a major church parking lot that's kitty-corner from the apartment building, and one of the options that we can explore is, can you use those kind of surface lots for commercial parking as well? There's lots of issues with that, but that's what was illustrated by this. Here's a project that's on Division. You can see, once again, there's some congested park spaces. This is 23 units with no parking within a few block radius. There is a supply of on-street parking. This is not in the really heavily redeveloping part of Division. Now, I don't want to misrepresent the condition here. Here's another example I thought was illustrative, because this is a very sort of busy intersection and commercial area. This is at Hawthorne by Ladd's Addition. This one's 51 units, but they also provide 34 spaces. And again, you can sort of see the pattern of congestion that, especially on the commercial frontages, there's congestion. On the neighborhood streets, there's some available parking. The last one I wanted to just show is the Hopworks, or the EcoFlats project at Williams and Shaver. Interesting, because this is 16 units, no parking, so it's a nice 18 units, no parking, an interesting size, but it also has a parking lot that it uses for its commercial uses and includes a couple of car share spaces with the whole intent of providing an alternative for its residents to use. The last piece of our research was to try to take a look at the cost impacts of providing parking, and we looked at your typical kind of a quarter-acre lot in the city, which is where a lot of these buildings are being built, and we looked at what it would take in terms of the cost of providing the parking, and those costs are shown on this slide, and then we also took a look at when you provide parking, you're getting fewer units because they're compete. You got to use up the space for parking. What's that do to the overall rate of return on the unit, and what's the rent premium that one might expect? And what we discovered is that for this tuck-under parking, where you're providing, you know, maybe one per every 4 units, a 0.25 kind of ratio, the rent premium, based on our modeling, was about 6%. So you provide the parking, and if it's going to go flow to the rent cost, it could go up by 6%. Podium parking, which is where you take the whole first floor and provide parking, you can get more parking. You get fewer units. You have this issue, too, where you might get dead space on the street, but put that aside for a moment. The rent premium was around 16%. And then for the more mechanical, the underground, these bigger sort of cost parking moves, the rent premium got up to over 30%. On November 13th, we had the Planning and Sustainability Commission had a public forum where we presented the results of this. And at that forum, the Planning Commission and Sustainability Commission instructed us to follow up on these steps. It said, you know, it wants to take a look at this threshold idea. It wants to us to come back with options to improve disabled accessibility when you don't have parking. The ability to provide parking for people with disabilities is limited. So what do we do with that? They wanted us to make sure that our regulations were working so that the frequent transit routes in the code are really the frequent transit routes. And then in a longer term kind of way, they asked us to explore what if our parking requirements were linked to things that we know more directly have the chance to lower vehicle dependency, and what if you reduced your parking ratios if you did some of those things. For instance, subsidized bus passes, provide for car share, that kind of thing that they call transportation demand management. What if those provisions? It takes more to figure that out. That's a longer range solution, but we were asked to explore that as well. And that concludes my comments.
Great, Charlie. Thank you.
Joe, I've been curious. You talked about the rent premium, mm-hmm. which assumes that if you get the parking on site, that the cost of that gets passed through per unit. And so it begs the question, in some of the new development that doesn't have parking, are the units priced at a discount to the market to reflect the fact that you don't have parking, or are we seeing, as some people suggested to me, that the market is now reached a point where people who don't have parking are being priced, the units are priced at roughly the same cost to the consumer as units that do have parking?
Yeah, that's a good point, Commissioner, and we don't know. We didn't get that information. I don't know what it is today, but, you know, in this 3-4% vacancy rate, the rent premium that you get from just having that low vacancy rate probably looks like the cost of parking is passed, or the savings are not being passed on. I would not be surprised if what people are telling you is the result today. When the market's back more in balance with the supply, and some of the market forecasts suggest that this is, you know, a year away, it's 1,200, 2,000 units added to the supply, you got to compete. So, you know, the principles of the past that are sort of the market fundamentals would say if you got parking and that's an amenity, you're going to be able to charge more for it. Or some people are actually separating the cost of the parking from the unit. You rent the space separately, which is not a bad thing. So if the market was more in balance, I would expect the rent premium not to be passed on. Right now, the vacancy rate's so high, I wouldn't be surprised if you're not seeing the differential.
Other questions for Joe? So thank you, Joe. And before we proceed, so it's my intention that obviously we've got a bunch of people signed up that want to comment on the work that's been done so far. We want to try to get a sense of the council for going forward. As Commissioner Fritz suggested, one of the options is to direct the Bureau to fairly swiftly move forward with potential code changes. The options are do nothing, wait for the comp plan, or do something now, I guess. Maybe there are other options. And then if that's the case, that will circle back to us via the Planning and Sustainability Commission, if that is what we do direct today. The commission held a fairly extensive forum on the same subject matter, as was mentioned not long ago. I don't know if he's actually signed up to testify, but I see we have the chair here, Mr. Baugh, so I don't know if you signed up. But if you'd like to comment, we'll extend you the courtesy, or you can sit in and listen once again.
Just here to listen.
Okay. So with that, thank you, Joe, and let's take the public testimony that we have, and we'll go from there.
We have 21 testifiers sign up. Would the first four come up, please? Gary Davenport, Terry Parker, Kathy Lambert, Sandy Polishuk. They'll be followed by Alan Field, Linda Nedekoven, Cheryl Ofam, William Gregg, and Jeff Sakamoto.
Thank you all for coming. Many of you have probably been here before. You know the procedure is a 3-minute limit, and if you're representing an organization, please state your name for the record, and if you're representing an organization, please let us know what organization that is. Thank you very much.
I just want to make sure this mic is working before my time starts.
Press the button.
Press the button right there.
Is it working? Okay. Hello, my name's Gary Davenport. I represent
Suite
Overlook.
Suite 120 Treasury Office on the first floor. Request
okay.
Immediate security
Just don't
assistance.
Start my time. I need
For
the time.
For your safety, City Hall occupants should remain clear of Suite 120 Treasury Office until further notice. 120. 120. Suite 120 Treasury Office on the first floor. Request immediate security assistance. For your safety, City Hall occupants should remain clear of Suite 120 Treasury Office until further notice. 120.
Let's just hang on a minute and
okay.
See what we've got here. Hopefully it was someone pushing the little button in their office that didn't know it was there, which happened in my office this week.
That's what happened? As we were all rushing to come to your defense?
Yes, it right. It was a complete false alarm. We thought it was something to do with the air conditioning. Okay, I think we're probably fine.
Excuse okay, thank you.
Please proceed. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Gary Davenport. I represent Overlook Neighborhood for responsible growth, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The parking exception and type 2 design review combo will soon cause irreparable harm to our neighborhoods. It ignores the uniqueness of our neighborhoods and uses an administrative checklist to remove all judgment and guesswork from the permitting process. According to Joe Zinder, the parking exception potentially affects over 70,000 of our city's lots. Developers of these 30 to 50,000 square foot structures avoid a complete design review because of a single footnote in a table that lets them opt out if any residential units are planned. The contact with neighborhood requirement is a disaster. Immediately following a presentation by the developer, residents, often hearing this for the first time, are expected to immediately set aside their shock and rage to come up with meaningful requests that a developer can then legally ignore. Developers, unwilling or afraid to face residents, frequently send their architects for the presentations instead. It's no surprise that a few unscrupulous developers have jumped in to erect cheap, no-parking apartments for the sole purpose of maximizing profit, all in the name of urban renewal. In preparation for our meeting with the architect on November 1st, we set aside our anger and frustration and drafted a positive vision of a no-parking apartment that might integrate into our neighborhood. We hope the document might serve as a blueprint to help the city and other neighbors explore new solutions. We sent it to our developers, City Council, BPS, and BDS, as we feared our developer responded with a couple of small minor adjustments, none of which addressed any of our concerns. In November, BPS released its parking study. It confirmed that about three-quarters of the tenants would own cars. As expected, BPS proposed no solutions and failed to address the impact on homeowners and businesses. The study spoke of how far a tenant might have to walk to get to their cars, but made no attempt to quantify the impact these buildings and extra cars have had on our safety, traffic, character, or livability. Despite overwhelming testimony in opposition to the study, the meeting closed with the Planning Commission saying that a moratorium was off the table and assurances that no significant changes would be made. The Oregonian got it right the next day, responding to the commission with their lead editorial, damaging Portland's livability. Meanwhile, our clock is ticking. Our developer has submitted permit applications on December 2nd and is pushing ahead for approval. Neighbors continue to push forward. Richmond and Kearns have both pressed LUBA lawsuits. LUBA is reviewing both cases and judgments will come soon. Beaumont and Overlook have each met with a land use attorney and are willing to see if permits will be granted. Waiting to see if permits will be granted. Overlook has formally requested site visits from each of you and has been conducting site visits and interviews with the press. All said, we remain hopeful that the new city council will work with us and move into the solution space. We ask you to immediately stop issuing permits to projects seeking the parking exception and work with us to find a responsible interim solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Terry Parker, Northeast Portland. I'm speaking for myself today, but I was also part of the citywide land use parking apartment without parking task force.
May I have your attention, please? You may disregard the previous message. It is all clear. You may resume your normal activities. Thank you.
And you may resume with 3 minutes.
Okay.
You may resume with a full complement.
I will resume. I was on the citywide land use task force studying this issue. The results of that will be, and the recommendations will be presented by somebody else. I support those recommendations. It is, and I'm going to deviate a little bit from what I'm handing out. It's fundamentally wrong for a developer to make a profit on a multi-unit apartment complex with no off-street parking, which in turn creates a neighborhood impact whereby existing households and businesses in the same neighborhood are then required to pay on-street parking permit fee. The family car represents the true meaning of freedom of mobility. History clearly demonstrates higher rates of personal mobility significantly contribute to greater economic productivity, which in turn generates higher income jobs. Metro's latest study reveals 80+% of trips in Portland are made by car, clearly signifying that automobiles are the preferred mode of transit by the citizens of Portland. The Metro survey also found that children are a major travel generator. While a two-person household makes about twice as many trips as a one-person household, a household with two children makes more than three times as many trips as a two-person household with no children. Anti-car advirocrats are driving many families to live in the suburbs, which also can include longer commutes. Correspondingly, the city's own study found that residents of apartments with no off-street parking are not less likely to own a car. Among the residents that responded, the survey found that 72% owned cars, and two-thirds of those owners parked their car on the street. Moreover, the survey found that 36% used the car for a daily commute, which means that many of the other cars are stored on the street all day long in front of nearby businesses and homes in neighborhoods that previously had adequate on-street parking. The result is a decrease in the value of these properties, thereby creating a transfer of wealth from existing taxpayers to the developer. Add on a fee-based parking permit system for existing residents and businesses that attempts to ration on-street parking, and again, the developer wins while existing businesses and residents lose. The street should not be the primary parking place for a car when not in use. Existing residents and businesses should be grandfathered in and not required to pay on-street, should not be required to park on neighborhood streets when available. Basically, what I'm saying is that they shouldn't have to pay to park in front of their house when the deficiency is created due to the construction of a new multi-unit complex with no off-street parking. The issue here is where the car is stored. Even though the property level in Portland is, or the poverty level in Portland is close to 20%, only about 18% of households are without a car. For some people, owning a car is a choice, but for others, it is often related to the lack of income. The implication here is that owning a car is an important priority, including for renters and households of low income. Minimal off-street parking, enough to handle all tenant-owned vehicles, needs to be required for all new multi-unit apartment developments, even on so-called frequent transit service routes. The parking mess socially engineering created in Northwest Portland must not be duplicated elsewhere in Portland. Thank you.
Terry, thank you very much. Thanks. Folks, let's raise your hand if you like what you hear, but let's try to keep it calm. And please proceed. 3 minutes. Thank you. Just state your name for the record.
My name is Kathy Lambert. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and City Council members and BPS members for allowing me to speak today. My name is Kathy Lambert, and I am the owner of Division Hardware, located at 37th and Division Street, just across the street from where the proposed 82-unit apartment complex is being built, with no provision for off-street parking. We have been in this location since 1987 and have established a large local clientele that enjoy coming to our store for their projects rather than going to the big boxes, because they know they can get the help they need and usually find the product they can use to complete their project. We have people coming in for pipe, conduit, lumber, 60-pound bags of concrete, potting soil, 5-gallon buckets of paint, things that aren't practical to transport by TriMet bicycle or being carried walking. Our customers need a place to park, and it is already getting difficult for them to find parking, as it is with all the contractors taking up all the parking spaces around our store, and the building isn't even completed yet. Once the residents of the 82-unit apartment building move in there, there will be absolutely no place to park within a reasonable distance of trying to purchase for my customers or my employees. I am in the process of trying to purchase the vacant lot right next door to our store on the east side in order to put parking there. I had seen the owner of that lot actually tie a rope to the wall of the house that used to be there and pull it down. This was several years ago. He passed away in 2010, and his wife just passed away this past May in 2012. Their son has an interest in real estate in Los Angeles, and I have sent him an email. And just today, I have also negotiated, or I'm in contact with Cushman Wakefield to make a proposal on purchasing that lot. When we first moved to this location, we were required to have off-street parking, which we did. We had a parking garage, however, we could only have like 4 or 5 parking units or spots in that location. Then the city changed the ruling, so we closed up the garage, and it is currently our cash register area, our paint department, and our lawn and garden department, so we are able to expand the selection for our customers. I am all for growth in the city of Portland, but it must be responsible growth. And so far, the city is not being responsible to the neighbors in our neighborhoods. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Sandy Polishek. I'm here as an individual. I live two blocks from that first building that was shown today, Irvington Gardens. I find it interesting that the report didn't include the fact that 19% of the those surveys said, only 19% said it was never hard to find parking. That obviously means 80%, 81% did have a hard time finding parking. He acknowledged that our parking is congested now, and this is from one building. I find it really interesting that the study only looked at areas where one building had been added to the area. Yes, maybe you can absorb that. You have more congestion. What happens when the second building is built, or the third, or more? I think you're going to hear from some people, for instance, in the Division area where that has happened, and they didn't choose to study one of those areas. They chose one that only had one building. So I don't think my area can absorb another building, and we're zoned apartments, obviously. So I'm just kind of holding my breath, waiting for that day to come when I'm not going to be able to park. There are always unanticipated and unintended consequences with these moves. None of us has a perfect crystal ball. We all know what China's one-child policy did. Those certainly were not intended, anticipated consequences. I worry that those things are going to show up too late. The buildings will be there, and then it will be really expensive to fix it. There is acknowledgement that we have a shortage of rentals right now, and that's what's driven up prices. It's scarcity. And old buildings that can't blame it on current building costs, their rents are up too. So I think if you're really concerned about high rents, the city needs to look at rent control. I just close by saying that I think that wishful thinking doesn't make it so. I understand the city would like to change our car culture. I don't think it's by impacting our livability in a negative manner. It would be much more helpful if you would see that TriMet's budget was restored so that we would have more frequent and later running buses and trains. I think that would be a much more fruitful path, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks very much.
The next four, please come up. Alan Field, Linda Nedekoven, Cheryl Oldham, William Gregg. They'll be followed by Jeff Sakamoto, Jerry Sue Lent, Michael Hayes, and Joe Meyer.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Alan, I think you're first.
Okay, and William Gregg, would you come up next?
I'm here. It's there.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Cheryl's the one that was.
So, oh, I see. We have Jeff Jeff Sakamoto. We Cheryl said she didn't want to speak, and so we have room for one more. Thank you.
Okay, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, commissioners. My name is Alan Field. I live in the Richmond neighborhood. I live three blocks of Division, which is the eye of the storm. And I say storm because it's been referred to as a perfect storm. We have a lot of intense development on Division and elsewhere, where you have developers taking advantage of a code which was not intended or envisioned to lead to this result. You all see what's going on in Division, but quickly, there are nine new buildings going in on a seven-block stretch. Six of those buildings are going in after this parking study. Three buildings alone are going in at the 33rd and Division. By my count, there are about 320 new units going in on a seven-block stretch. According to the 0.9 average parking ratio, that's about 290 cars, almost 300 cars. Then you add in the impact that each of these buildings will have one to three destination restaurant or bar. The study doesn't go into that. You're going to have likes of Pock Pock, St. Honoré, Boulangerie, Salt and Straw, Wafu, going in. There's going to be up to 9 to 30 new destination places. I actually like that. I mean, Division was voted the hottest restaurant district in the city at this point. I like that aspect. But I really feel for the residents to live within two blocks whose driveways are being blocked. all of this is foreshadowing even bigger changes. 75% of the property between 19th and 50th is zoned to allow for four-story buildings with no parking. I think we all agree we need to do a better job to balance livability with the need to accommodate density. I'm in the neighborhood PEG Center for the comp plan, the policy expert group. At the last meeting, we focused on parking, and there was a consensus that the current policy and implementation of off-street parking for these buildings need to be modified. The Richmond Neighborhood Association presented one idea of a minimum parking requirement, and I passed that around. But I understand that may not translate to citywide application. So I came up with my own personal alternative plan, which is now in front of you, to have developers first do a parking demand study. You know, let's not wait every 10 years to do a study like the city do. Let's every building assess what parking demand is. And second, have perhaps a low minimum parking requirement for buildings 40 and over, but let's look at the cumulative effect. If there's already three buildings, there are already so many units, let's up the minimum requirement of units. Also, there could be a waiver option that developers could be allowed to do away with this minimum requirement if they put in so much money to really attract car-free tenants. It's not good enough for developers to put in a few bike hooks and bike lockers and a picture of a bicycle on their advertising, and that's the end of it. They really need to be incentivized with rent rebates, creative ways to really attract car-free people with car share membership. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Linda? Good afternoon, Mayor Hills and City Councilors. My name is Linda Nedekoven. I live in the Hosford-Abernathy neighborhood, and our neighborhood has had many respectful discussions on this topic. However, today I'm speaking for myself. Other folks are raising a lot of the issues and concerns that I have, and I'm just going to hit three ideas quickly. One, I want to reemphasize this notion of the cumulative impacts and the need to create a system in whatever strategies we use going forward that assures those cumulative impacts are understood and studied regularly. We're still struggling with the zoning approach that we used in the 80s where we zoned everything R1 on our commercial corridors to keep housing in the inner city, and that has never been fully rectified, and it's, you know, 2012, 13. So we need to find ways to be looking at the cumulative changes that happen in neighborhoods over time. One size won't fit all. The kind and the sequence of change that will be happening in different neighborhoods will vary, and the code needs to consider both the cultural history and the carrying capacity of neighborhoods as we think about cumulative impacts. What can the natural and built infrastructure absorb? And secondly, what makes a place special and creates its identity that we don't want to strip away as we try to accommodate more growth? In terms of infrastructure in particular, besides the usual streets and sidewalks and sewers, what's happening with parks, open space, community gardens? Where are those 300 folks living in those new units going to go in the Division Street area when we are already park deficient and are consistently told that there is no money for land acquisition on the east side of the river, inner east side, because it's too expensive? We do wonder sometimes where our SDCs are going as these buildings are being cranked out. But we need to figure out how we're going to accommodate those needs. It doesn't sound like the right approach to creating vibrant neighborhood centers or an elder-friendly city if we don't find a way to build in open space and parks. And the final thing is one other follow-up issue that Joe's already mentioned is the comprehensive parking assessment and loading zone assessment, I would say. Asking the city to play its role as convener and bring together the developers, neighbors, property owners, tenants, business owners to look at available parking and loading zone needs in a given area, whether it's to really create a parking demand management committee over time or at least to make the meetings happen. So we look at how we optimize, whether it's surface parking lots or the use of private driveways in neighborhoods. At times, they're not being used by the owners. I'll say more about some of these things in email, but thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks.
Hello, my name is William Gregg, representing the Buckman neighborhood. I live in an area greatly affected by these relaxed building regulations. I'm also a small housing developer. Whenever I develop a property, I'm faced with a myriad set of zoning and building codes, codes on setbacks, heights, green space, et cetera, and yes, parking. All are very strict codes that I have to follow. Yet I'm now seeing that when it comes to these larger apartment projects, the parking requirements are being thrown out the window, 70-unit buildings being built on small lots with no parking. Yet up to 72% of these tenants, like Joe said, still possess cars, and thus create an overly dense parking problem on the accompanying streets. Oftentimes, these cars are generally using the street to store their cars, maybe using them once or twice a week, sometimes hardly at all. Streets built for X number of cars are now being asked to carry twice or three times that number. We also face parking from patrons of nearby businesses, which compounds the problem that much more. Higher density has already been achieved in my Buckman neighborhood through the rental of individual rooms and houses. To target Southeast Portland for the thousands of people who will be coming to the city will cause a huge blow to our standard of living if the city continues to allow this parking exemption. I, for one, do not want our neighborhoods turned into New York City. My own house was built with a carriage garage unsuitable for the cars of today, so we park on the street, or try to, in the spaces in front of the house. But now competing with an apartment house that has zero off-street parking and only six on-street spaces. Ask yourself if you would want to park two or three blocks away from your own house, lugging three bags of groceries back to your home, not to mention a woman late at night doing the same. And by parking blocks away, I'm taking the spots in front of somebody else's house, which, again, is unfair to them. For those of you who live in the suburbs, you can only imagine this lack of parking problem, but trust me, it is real. I urge you to require an adequate amount of bundled parking for these building projects. I once thought that if they are going to get this parking exemption, that they should only be allowed to rent to people without cars. I guess that's not legal, but I still think this would be a viable requirement, especially since this whole exemption has been brought on by being close to mass transit anyway, non-car people for non-car buildings, or that we be allowed to set up parking zones that exclude the people with cars who rent in these buildings. And as far as comment to Joe, I'd like him to stay in my neighborhood for a couple days and tell us what he thinks then. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My name is Jeff Sakamoto. You press the red button.
Oh, wait, yeah. There you go. That. Right there on the base of the microphone.
Yeah. Okay. My name is Jeff Sakamoto. I hadn't planned on speaking, so forgive me if I'm not as articulate as these folks, but I just want to bring a little bit different perspective. And I'll admit, when I first heard of a development without parking, I thought it was ludicrous. Over the last several years, as a lender, as an investor, as a consultant, and now as a property owner, I've researched this over the last few years and actually visited other cities, other metropolitans, where this is actually quite frequent. And my opinions have changed, especially looking at a city like Seattle. I'm from Seattle. We've funded a lot of developments up in Seattle. And the similarities to Portland are much more close than what you'd find in New York or LA or what have you. What we found is in these developments, in these densely populated areas that have provided parking, many times they're not used. In fact, in some of these, car ownership is below 30%. And so what has happened is these developers have started to provide no parking, and what's happened is those residents have made choices with their pocketbook. They've chosen to pay for storage on the outskirts of the city to store their cars. They've chosen to sell their cars in many cases. Where it hits close to home is our daughter, who actually is attending the University of Washington and owned a car and chose to sell her car shortly upon arriving because the cost of storage and parking in Seattle was too high. So in my opinion, the problem can best be solved not by mandating requirements for parking by developers and passing on those rent increases, which you can do the studies you want to, but the reality is the rents increase because parking is one of the largest costs in development, both opportunity cost and direct costs. Those are passed on. But in reality, in my opinion, the best way to solve this problem, and I know it might not be popular, is to raise the cost of parking on street, whether via permits, whether via metered systems, which they use demand-based parking in areas like Seattle and San Francisco, that have been proven to reduce car ownership. And again, the way to change behavior is through folks' pocketbooks. And the reality is we're going through some growing pains, and I understand the frustration that these folks have, but it's the two of the buzzwords that every city and the issues they face are sustainability and affordable housing. And in my opinion, these projects without parking are the most sustainable ways to prepare this city for the future and a way to provide affordable housing for these Gen Y folks, these folks that are coming from different areas across the country.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you all.
Next, please come up. Jerry Sue Lent, Michael Hayes, Joe Meyer, Richard Mello, and they will be followed by Marianne Schwab, Ellen Burr, Doug Plotz, and John Urbanowski.
Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Nice to meet you, Mayor, at least from here and so forth. I'm Joe Meyer, and from my perspective, you know, the combination of city policy from the 80s regarding apartments without parking and the demand, market demand for such housing is kind of like a pile of gold in the street. That's how I see it. And this council has something to say about that, something to say about how it will be hauled away. The first question someone might have if they see a pile of gold is, how much gold did you say? And it's hard to know citywide, but just from throwing some rough numbers together, you know, from 32nd to 39th on Division, over 300 units are planned. And according to the BPS, requiring parking takes a $700 rent to a $1,200 rent. We know where that $500 is going. So roughly that's $200,000 every month. Every month, and the goose just keeps on laying. You know, to put that in perspective, a parking overnight parking pass is $5 a month. We have to think of, you know, how much gold is in the street. What's at stake here? You know, that's enough to have a well-qualified teaching assistant for every teacher at my elementary school. There's a lot on the table. The second question about the pile of gold is, how did it get there? And in the first approximation, you might think it's the small business owners and the neighbors of these very areas of the city that's being affected because they're so desirable. And as Mr. Zender pointed out, the city policy of the 80s, again, allowed these developments without parking and with really nothing for the surrounding neighbors. And I guess I'm calling on the city to readdress that in light of the demand, in light of the $200,000 just for a half a mile on Division. Let's reassess that. You know, piles of gold can drive men mad, as we know. I believe this council has jurisdiction and responsibility to see that everyone's interest is maintained. So I'm really asking you to consider a moratorium on this kind of development until we can really assess needs. There's old people that can be affected. There's lots of things we can do, and there's lots of money to do it with. So let's take a time out. With so much gold lying in the street, I'm sure Portland can find an equitable solution. Thanks for listening to me.
My name is Jerry Sue Lent. I'm not here to speak to the city. I'm here to speak to my neighborhood. I live in the Solid Moreland area. This is a very pleasant place to live. And I've been troubled because after 35 years of occupancy in my residence, suddenly large apartment buildings with no on-site parking are going in. This is very interesting. About 30 years ago, I was involved in discussions of infill, as we called it. And the concept of infill is a very rational one and one that I really appreciated. But that's not what's happening here. I know that there are many buses that run on Division and in that part of town, but in my part of town, there are no buses. I live in what I call a transit desert. And yet, I'm being asked to accept a building on 17th and Tacoma of 46 units, which there is no transit there. And the whole concept is there will be transit. That's why there's no on-site parking required. Another building is going in at 23rd and Tacoma, which will have 68 units. I asked the builder, how could he put this in when there wasn't any transit? He said, there's transit. I said, well, what transit are you speaking of? And he said, well, the Tacoma light rail station is going in. I said, but that's not near your building. And he said, it is in a straight line across McLaughlin and up Tacoma and down to the station. I just couldn't even take that seriously. There is no reason to sacrifice the quality of life in my neighborhood so that some people can have housing. It's really important that we have housing. People shouldn't have to live on the street. But preceding that is transit. We must have bus service. Now, I'm going to tell you, my other car is a bicycle, and my real car is a bicycle. And I resent not having a bus to ride from downtown Portland to my house. If I ride my bicycle, it takes 20 minutes. If I take the bus, it takes 45 minutes. What I'm asking you to do is look at the issues of livability. When Joe talks about the supply of on-street parking and the effect on the cost of apartment units by having on-street or on-site parking, where is the discussion of congestion? Where is the discussion of safety? We're very concerned about the building on 17th and Tacoma because there's no place for fire trucks, police trucks, ambulances. There's nothing there. So please, when you are looking at the code, look at incorporate issues of humanity, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Michael Hayes. I'm surprised to see Jerry here today. She's a neighbor. So it's not ganging up on anybody. We're just we've been motivated by the circumstances, and I'd like to share a few comments that relate in a way to a part of what Jerry has said. I strongly support well-designed and appropriately sited multifamily housing that is a good long-term investment for its owners and a place that each of us would be proud to call home. I don't think we're really consistently getting to that objective under current policy, and I have great hopes for the comprehensive plan review. I'm involved in that process. But there's something that I would like you to consider perhaps as an interim measure, and I think it probably be a good long-term measure as well. I recommend that the design review process be applied to multifamily projects more broadly, set a threshold, say 10 units, and make it mandatory. Because under current optional guidelines, under design review, there's at least the hope for an opportunity to address design failures, which won't be addressed by code compliance checks. And let me cite one project that Jerry already cited as an example, the one at 17th and Tacoma. Westbound traffic on Tacoma at that location is funneled into a narrow corridor. There's a traffic lane that runs along the curb, and then there's a left turn lane. There is absolutely no on-street parking. We have in the approval process, perhaps it's already been approved, a 46-unit property, which is going to be built to the front property line. There is no space for pull-off out of traffic to let out a passenger, to park your U-Haul trailer, to unload your furniture. Yeah, it doesn't exist. There's no service bay. There is no on-site parking. It's 100%, and it's zero parking on the property. I don't necessarily oppose to zero parking. I used to underwrite projects for HUD. I'm retired now, but I was the director of the multifamily housing program there. And I approved a 100-year, hopefully it'll be 100-year, 100-unit project in the Pearl with zero parking. I got a lot of raised eyebrows from my associates, but I thought it made sense. And we entertained other proposals. I'm rather skeptical that lenders and underwriters for mortgage insurance and, on an ongoing basis will look very kindly at projects that don't provide basic amenities for their tenants. And I think those projects may, if they're poorly sited, be poor long-term investments, and they could potentially be blights on the neighborhood. This one at Tacoma and 17th, when we asked the architect representative for the owner, how do you expect to attract tenants? He said, well, I think people with bicycles are going to live here. You know, they won't be bothered with no parking. Well, this bicycle-oriented four-story building doesn't have an elevator. The storage for the bicycles in each individual unit, so you carry your bicycle up to the second floor, the third floor, and the fourth floor.
Need you to wrap up?
I think that is, that's not going to work well. I think I better wrap it up now. I left some comments with the clerk, and okay. You might want to look at those. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Richard Mello, and I just want to say thank you for allowing all of us to come and present today. I'm a member of the Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth, and I live pretty near the site. I live one block from the site at 37th Division, which is going to include 81 units. And, I just wanted to point out that when Joe was making his presentation earlier about the parking study, he was showing buildings that have 50 units. This one has 81. This is going to just change the complexion of where I live. I live along a short dead-end street. All day and all night long, people zip up and down that street thinking it's a through street. The one block over Carruthers, I live on Sherman. One block over on Carruthers is another dead-end street. Same thing, cars are going up and down all day and all night looking for, well, actually what they're looking for is an outlet. We're going to combine that with people who are also looking for parking now. I have in front of my house, which is on a corner, there are 6 parking spaces along the street. Often I can't find a park, and that building's not even built yet. But this is really a serious concern of mine. In addition, there's the traffic consideration. I use my bicycle all the time. Clinton Street and Lincoln Streets, which are designated bike lanes, are now filled with cars all the time because Division, which has 11 new buildings going in and 7 without parking, as has been mentioned earlier, Division Street is so congested now, as is Hawthorne and Powell for that matter. There's so much congestion that cars are using Clinton and Lincoln more than ever and making it very difficult to use those for bicycle commuting and running and walking dogs and all that matter. As far as our group is very pro-growth, we don't want vacant lots. We don't want, the old Egyptian room building. I'm glad it's gone. I'm glad that something is going in at 37th and Division. But we just want responsible growth. We want the type of buildings that will have design features that invite the community in and provide some level of parking or a small enough number of units that we're able to, people are able to find parking along the street. So just to clarify on exactly what we're asking for, we'd like some kind of change that would say no apartment buildings over a certain size or any new building over a certain size should include some kind of parking. I'm not sure exactly what the ratio is. Other people have probably studied that more than I have, but something that's reasonable. If you're going to have 81 units, you cannot be so irresponsible to provide zero on-site parking. And second, we'd like any new building over a certain size to automatically have some kind of public hearing where citizens in the neighborhood are able to give input on the design of the building. I think this is not asking too much. I think this is something that that will help increase the livability of our city. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thanks very much.
Next, we have Marianne Schwab, Doug Klotz, John Urbanowski, Chris Smith, and they'll be followed by Dina Marshall, Tamara Ritter, Richard Lischner, and Mike Schwarzenberger.
Good afternoon. I think some handouts there for us, so Sue will get those to us. Was Marianne the first? I don't remember. I think you were.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Marianne Schwab. I live in the inner southeast Sunnyside neighborhood. I've been a resident for well over 40 years. 1978, I did speak in opposition to this very issue. I'm here again. I can't guarantee I'll be here in 2035 to challenge it again. Ultimately, infill, and this is a buzzword here, condo sites within 500 feet frequently operating transit service were exempt from providing on-street parking. These no on-site parking zone designations, associated parking exemptions, were applied in the early 1990s. They've been reviewed again in the 2000s. Here we are, 2013, reviewing again. Lots of paper in between. Currently, are generally applied to streets that have frequent transit service, access to daily services with high walkability. Please note, I've given you copies attached, the frequently asked